The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is for English learners, so we speak a bit slower. And we use words and phrases with English learners in mind. Here are the stories we have for you today. For the Education Report, Alice Bryant tells us about an English teacher in Panama. Then Dr. Jill Robbins and Gregory Stockel report about an Afghan woman who earned top marks on a national test. I will return with this week's words and their stories. And we end the program with The Making of a Nation, our ongoing series about U.S. history. But first, here is Alice Bryant.
Every Friday afternoon, Joel Alvarez gets his disco lights and music ready. When he turns on the Zoom camera at 6 o'clock, he is surrounded by blue lighting or lights of some other color. Sometimes he adds a hat or a special piece of clothing. Then he is ready for the party. But this is not just any party. It is also an English class at the University of Panama. And Alvarez is not just the event's DJ. He is also the professor. During these weekly parties, students play competitive grammar games in teams. The winning team gets to hear their favorite songs. At the university, Alvarez is known for working especially hard to connect with students and help them expand their professional goals. He is a respected educator in Panama, involved in everything from training English teachers to planning and speaking at conferences. Yet, that is still only part of the story. Alvarez has a whole other life in humanitarian causes. In the past several months, that has taken the form of helping needy families and school children around Panama City. During the coronavirus crisis, Alvarez has been identifying local families who need food and other assistance. He requests and gathers donations from friends and other people. He goes to the stores to purchase supplies. And he delivers the donations himself to the families.
I try to identify where is the real need, where there is impact.
Alvarez says he visits with the families when he makes deliveries. He talks with parents about how important it is for their children to continue their education, even with schools closed across the nation. Francisco Santa Maria is one of Alvarez's friends and a donor. Sometimes he goes with Alvarez on his delivery trips. Santa Maria likes meeting the families and hearing about their lives because, in his words, if we are living in our bubbles, we will never know how difficult a time others are having. Alvarez says that the number of people willing to help his aid operation keeps growing. In July, a friend of the professor asked their friend group to help provide aid to a local home for the elderly. They have been delivering food, clothing, and supplies such as disinfectant products and face coverings. Along with providing basic necessities, Alvarez volunteers as an English teacher for children in low-income neighborhoods. The families of these 7, 8, and 9-year-old students do not have computers, but they do have cell phones. So Alvarez teaches them in small groups over video calls. Alvarez says changes in Panama's education system has left the country without a strong reading culture. So now he is gathering donations of books for a nearby elementary school. His longer-term plan is to start a reading circle program at several local schools. Volunteer teachers would lead the circles. I'm Alice Bryant.
And now, a story from Afghanistan.
An Afghan woman received the highest score last week out of 170,000 students on the National University Entrance Examination. Shamsia Alizada is the daughter of an Afghan coal miner. During the Taliban rule, Afghan girls could not go to school. Now, she hopes to become a doctor and is winning widespread praise for her success. Her path has not been easy. 2 years ago, an Islamic State militant suicide bombing in West Kabul killed many classmates at a school she was attending. At the time, they were preparing for exams. She had changed her plans at the last minute to attend another event. She talked with Thomson Reuters Foundation and a coffee shop in Kabul. She spoke of wanting to work towards a brighter future for her troubled country. She thinks medicine is one of the ways she can help. She also wants to work to help the women of Afghanistan. Alizada now plans to study at the University of Kabul.
She hopes to become a brain surgeon, but is also considering a diplomatic career. She told VOA's Afghan service, "I want to bring change and serve my country. I will try, and my goal is to prepare myself to be able to even become the president." Alizada's success comes at an important time for the country. The government this month began power-sharing talks with the Taliban Islamist militant group. The Taliban ruled the country until 2001. Afghan women's rights have improved in many areas of daily life since those days. The Taliban did not let women go to work, and girls could not attend school. Now, many fear losing their hard-won gains. The Taliban say they have changed and will let girls go to school. Yet, fears remain that women's rights will not continue if the group regains influence. Alizada said her success in part comes from how her parents treated her. She was equal to her two brothers, something she said was rare in Afghanistan.
Like others born after the U.S.-led invasion, Alizada grew up with different opportunities from those her own family had. Her family's native province, Ghazni, is south of the capital. She went to the university campus to take the exams. Alizada is now waiting for university classes to start. She said she is spending her free time taking walks with her friends in the neighborhood or reading poetry.
Her older brother is studying engineering in India. She said she hoped to also win a scholarship to study in Britain, the United States, or Canada. She is not thinking only of herself. 10 years from now, she hopes to be practicing medicine. She also wants to see other women having similar success. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Greg Stockel.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. Each week on this program, we explain expressions often used in American English. We give you lots of examples. This way, you can learn how to use the expressions when you speak English. Today, we talk about a very serious thing, the end of the world. In both popular culture and religious works, the end of the world is sometimes called the apocalypse or Armageddon. You do not need me to tell you that the end of the world is a bad thing. It is also not likely to happen during our lifetime. Fingers crossed. As an expression, we use the end of the world to be dramatic, to overstate, or to sell rock and roll songs.
It's the end of the world as we know it.
Now let's listen to these two people using the term the end of the world.
What is wrong with Theo? Why is he crying so hard?
Sarah broke up with him.
But they were going out together for only a month.
I know.
Listening to him cry like that, you would think it was the end of the world.
Now, this expression is not all bad. In fact, we often use it in the negative form. When you want to say that things are not so bad, you can say, it's not the end of the world. In other words, whatever the situation is, it could be much worse. Here is an example.
Our football team was hoping to finish in first place, but it won't be the end of the world if we don't.
If I say that something bad is not the end of the world, I am trying to make myself or someone else feel better about it. And here are more examples.
I will be disappointed if we cancel our trip to Spain this year, but it won't be the end of the world. There is always next year. A rainy wedding day is not the end of the world. People will have fun no matter what the weather does. Losing your job does not have to be the end of the world. You will find another one.
If your English studies are coming along slowly, do not worry. It is not the end of the world. And to help, you can join me again next week for another Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
Thank you. From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. Last time, we talked about Martin Van Buren. He was sworn in as the 8th President of the United States in 1837. Not long after he took office, the United States suffered an economic depression. It lasted 6 years. The depression was the major problem during Van Buren's presidency, but not the only problem. In foreign affairs, one of the chief problems Van Buren faced was a dispute with Britain about Canada. Canadian rebels had tried twice to end British rule over Canada. They failed both times. Rebel leaders fled to safety in the United States. There, they found it easy to get men and supplies to help them continue their struggle. The rebels built a base on a Canadian island in the Niagara River, which formed part of the border between the two countries. The rebels used an American boat to carry supplies from the American side to their base. In December 1837, Canadian soldiers crossed the Niagara River and seized the boat. One American was killed in the fight. For a while, Canadian forces and the rebels exchanged attacks. A number of American citizens assisted the rebels. President Van Buren was troubled. He declared that the wish to help others become independent was a natural feeling among Americans. But he said no American had a right to invade a friendly country. He warned that citizens who fought against the Canadian government and were captured could expect no help from the United States. Another problem between the United States and Canada at that time concerned the border along the American state of Maine. That part of the border had been in dispute ever since 1783. That was when Britain finally recognized the independence of the United States. Years later, the King of the Netherlands agreed to decide the dispute. The king said it was impossible to decide the border from the words of the peace treaty between Britain and the United States. So he proposed what he believed was a fair settlement instead. The United States would get about twice as much of the disputed area as Canada. Britain accepted the proposal, but the United States did not. The United States refused because the state of Maine would not accept it. In 1838, Britain withdrew its acceptance of the proposal. Canadians entered the disputed area. The governor of Maine sent state militia forces to the area. The soldiers drove out the Canadians and built forts. Canada, too, began to prepare for war. President Van Buren sent General Winfield Scott to Maine. Scott was able to get the governor to withdraw his forces from the disputed area. He also received guarantees that Canadian forces would not enter the area. The danger of war passed. Americans in the border area, however, were angry with President Van Buren. They believed he was weak because he did not want war. The president was losing support, not only in the Northeast. People all over the country were suffering because of the Depression. Most people believed Van Buren was responsible for their troubles because he continued the hard money policies of former President Andrew Jackson. Historian Joel Silby is an expert on Martin Van Buren. He says most historians do not think Van Buren was a strong president. However, Joel Silby says Van Buren left an important legacy.
When it comes to the political system, he was a brilliant innovator.
Van Buren organized his political party, the group that came to be known as the Democrats. In the late 18th and early 19th centuries, people who supported independent farmers and states' rights over a central government generally followed Thomas Jefferson. They called themselves Democratic Republicans or Jeffersonian Republicans. Jeffersonian Republicans opposed the Federalist Party. They believed the Federalists wanted a strong national government, a powerful banking system, and a small elite social class. But after Thomas Jefferson died, the Jeffersonian Republicans broke into factions. They divided their support among several candidates during presidential elections, and as a result, often lost. Joel Silby says one of the things Van Buren had learned was that above all else, when you have an ideology you want to fight for, you need unity. Van Buren organized political clubs and political leaders in New York that all supported Jefferson's ideas. He brought them together to talk about their political beliefs and choose a single candidate for their party. In the 1828 election, Van Buren had expanded this organization. His insistence on political unity had helped elect Andrew Jackson, and his system of meetings eventually became the national conventions that political parties use today to officially nominate their candidates. Van Buren also helped create the modern political campaign. In the 1820s, he noticed many state constitutions were lifting some of their voting restrictions. As a result, more people were allowed to vote. Historian Joel Silby says Van Buren wanted to bring these new voters into his political party.
He borrowed from a couple of minor parties the notion of popular campaigns where you persuaded people through campaign rallies, speeches by prominent people, and on election day, getting them out to vote by your organization's agents.
Joel Silby explains that these techniques to persuade and mobilize voters were new to national politics. Now they are some of the major features of political campaigns. Martin Van Buren's political tactics earned him a few nicknames. Some called him the Little Magician because he knew how to win elections. Others called him the Sly Fox of Kinderhook. Kinderhook is the town in New York where Van Buren grew up. The term Sly Fox is not entirely positive. Joel Silby says the nickname suggests that many people did not feel they could trust him.
Van Buren is the first person to be seen as that, a manipulator. Unfairly, I said he would do anything to win an election, and he had no real principles.
However, Joel Silby says Van Buren did what he thought was necessary to preserve Jefferson's ideals. In the election of 1840, Van Buren ran for a second term as president. This time, his opponents used Van Buren's political skills against him. Joel Silby says the Whigs used popular speeches and rallies to portray Van Buren as a failed president.
During his reelection campaign in 1840, crowds of Whigs would chant, "Matty Van is a used-up man." because he no longer had any power or effect on things.
The Whigs also nominated a military hero they believed the people would love. He was General William Henry Harrison. Harrison had led an attack on Indians in the Indiana Territory in 1811. Many people believed that the battle at a place called Tippecanoe was a great victory for Harrison. But Van Buren's party, the Democrats, spoke of the 67-year-old Harrison as an old lady. They called him Granny Harrison. One Democratic newspaper said the old man did not really want to be president. It said Harrison would be happier with a $2,000 a year pension, a barrel of hard apple cider to drink, and a log cabin to live in. Hard apple cider was a popular drink among working men, and at that time, a great many farmers still lived in log cabins, houses made of rough logs. The Whigs were the party of bankers and businessmen. They saw a chance to use the Democrats' statement to their own gain. It gave them a way to present themselves as the party of the working man and the small farmer. "The statement is right," they cried. "The Whig Party is the party of hard cider and log cabins." The Whigs put up log cabins everywhere and offered free hard cider to everyone. They organized huge outdoor meetings for thousands with food and drink for all. They held parades and marched with flags, bands, and pictures of William Henry Harrison. Many campaign songs were written. These songs told of Harrison's bravery against the Indians. They told how he loved the hard and simple life of the common man, even though he was really a Virginia aristocrat. The Democrats made their own claims. They said Harrison could not read or write. They said he would not pay people the money he owed them. And they charged that Harrison even sold white men into slavery. Senator Henry Clay said the campaign was a struggle between log cabins and palaces, between hard cider and champagne. The state of Maine held elections in September of 1840. Voters in Maine elected a Whig, Edward Kent, as governor. They gave the state's electoral votes to Harrison, celebrated as the hero of Tippecanoe, and to his vice presidential candidate, John Tyler. The election results produced a new song for the Whigs, "And Have You Heard the News from Maine and What Old Maine Can Do?" She went hell-bent for Governor Kent, and Tippecanoe and Tyler too.
"Then let him talk about hard cider, 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 and log cabins too. It will only help to speed the ball for Tippecanoe and Tyler too, for Tippecanoe and Tyler too. And with them will beat little Van, 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 Van. Oh, he's a used-up man, and with them will beat little Van."
One by one, the other states voted. The election was close in the popular vote, but Harrison received 234 electoral votes compared to only 60 for Van Buren. And so William Henry Harrison became the 9th president of the United States. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History, from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. We hope you enjoyed it. Join us again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world.
I'm Anna Mateo.